The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. I wish we could welcome you back under more pleasant circumstances. At time of our recording now is 11 days into the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It's a highly unsettling situation. Our thoughts go out to the civilians of Ukraine and all that's going on there. It's really sad to see and disturbing to see those images.
It really is, yeah. I was just saying over the weekend, things aren't getting better, they're getting worse. And, and you're seeing, you know, more death, which is really sad to see.
It's really hard to think about other issues when all this is going on. And of course, what else is going on in our court? The energy world, oil and gas prices continue to go up. At time of recording, Brent is over $120 a barrel, WTI not far behind. In the past 60 years, only 5 years have averaged at this level, or about 8% of the time, going back all the way to the 1970s. So these are unique times, whichever way you measure it. And of course, the European natural gas prices. The Europeans are so dependent upon Russian gas, so it's about $50 an MMBTU. Just put that in perspective. I mean, I think we're still paying 4 or 5 here. So it's 10 times the natural gas price there. And that has all sorts of implications that we're going to discuss a little bit later in terms of what society does when it encounters that kind of price spike. There's also risks that are created in terms of the whole energy complex, in terms of policy implementations, and basically the whole energy policy priority lists get shuffled. And given the impact on the consumers' wallets and pocketbooks, especially those of lower income who commute a lot, I think we can expect to see more relief. We saw some relief today in Alberta with the repeal of the gasoline tax, or temporary offsetting of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, until oil prices get to a certain level, it's going to be taken away. That'll help, something like 13 cents a liter off the price of gasoline and diesel.
Yeah, usually you do see this sort of thing happen when the price of fuels go up in countries rapidly, is that the government typically steps in and has to moderate it for the consumer as a consequence. But ultimately, I mean, these prices are pretty high. We've talked about it before. You can almost assuredly expect a slowdown in the economy, a slowdown in consumption, people conserving, people finding alternative modes of transportation, carpooling, vanpooling, getting back to riding public transit now that the pandemic has eased. You can expect all that kind of stuff.
Biking,
yeah. Absolutely.
The electric bike, you'll be using that this spring, Peter.
I will be on that, of course. So the topics for today, as we think about all of these sobering things, is talk about the current situation, talk about my recent commentary in the Financial Post about how people like their energy, cheap, clean, safe, and secure. And other news, there's an IPCC report. We would be remiss in not mentioning that as well toward the end of the podcast.
All right, well, let's start with the first one, the current situation when it comes to energy flows for both gas and oil. Let's just start off by saying that the market is assuming major supply disruption. That's being factored into the price.
You know,
it's still uncertain, especially for gas. In fact, in gas, there has been no supply outage yet. For oil, there definitely is some curtailment of supply, although it's still a little uncertain what it is. But these prices are reflecting a significant outage. Now, if you go back even last week, the West, whether it be the US or Europe, continued to say they weren't going to affect the energy trade, you know, and because they didn't want to see these high prices. In fact, Biden stated in the State of the Union last week that he's taking robust action to make sure the pain of our sanctions is targeted at Russia's economy, and he will use every tool to protect American businesses and consumers. So I took that as they're not going to put sanctions. However, we find out this is what's caused the price to rise here in the last day, is that potentially the U.S. is considering cutting their imports of Russian crude, and potentially, maybe there'd be some cuts to Europe as well, still uncertain.
So it's about, what does the United States import from Russia? It's about 500,000?
500,000 barrels a day of, but you know, it's not all crude oil. It's actually about half crude oil and half products. So if they say it's a crude oil ban, they would still be bringing about half the rest in by refined products. Mm-hmm. So if it's a full-out ban, it would be 500,000 barrels a day.
So it's on consumption, total U.S. consumption of about 20 million?
In that range. So it's still going to cause some problems. You know, those refined products that come in are mostly heavy bunkers that are consumed by those heavy crude refineries. Mm-hmm. And so just like everything, not all two crudes are alike. So you can't necessarily replace that exactly with another product. So it'll probably create a little bit of uncertainty there. But I think the big thing is the market is very tight, and even 500,000 barrels a day coming out of it at the global level does create some problems and uncertainty.
The U.S. at 500,000 barrels per day, I mean, the Canadian import of Russian oil, which we've already banned, is de minimis, really. It's not
that. There was no crude, and I think it was around 20,000 barrels a day of refined products.
This is something that North America, you know, if we kind of dial it up here or there, we can probably handle. It's still that European situation where they're so heavily reliant upon imports, and, you know, that's where the real big issue is. And also the disruption to sort of the global trade. And by the way, even though countries have not necessarily said they're stopping importing of Russian oil and gas, you know, we've got some Western countries where the dock workers are refusing port unloading of these commodities because the unions are behind the Ukrainians.
Yeah, and you're seeing some refiners announce that they won't take Russian crude. We did have those SWIFT restrictions that we talked about briefly last week that shouldn't have affected the energy trade much, but I think they've created a lot of concerns. For example, some buyers are just avoiding buying them because they're not sure if that's going to change, right? Mm-hmm. There's issues with insurance, especially, you know, there's a major terminal in the Black Sea. And there was an article last week that some ships wouldn't go there because concerns around insurance rates. And, you know, Ukraine is asking that Turkey block those tankers. So could your tanker get stuck? I think all the uncertainty is creating a larger outage maybe than you would think. So there's definitely a problem. We saw last week that Russian crude called Urals, which typically discounts about $3 to Brent, fell to almost $20 discount last week. So that's just telling you that nobody wants to buy it. So they have to keep dropping the price to find a buyer. And so I think there definitely is a supply outage. It's just really uncertain how large that is. In terms of, we talked about these numbers last week, the exports from Russia are in the range of 6.5 million barrels a day. Like, that's just a huge number. But, you know, it's not likely that all of that gets removed from the global market.
Well, quite a bit goes to China.
Yeah, you got a bunch going to China. The other thing is that a whole bunch of the export terminals in Russia are onto Tidewater. In Canada, you know, we're landlocked, only selling our crude oil by pipeline to the United States. So if they put a sanctions on us, we'd have nowhere to go. But if we had Tidewater access like the Russians do, it gives you that opportunity to sell it to other buyers, maybe India, maybe China. Once it's on Tidewater, you know, you can move around. So if you consider the pipeline-connected exports, as well as, you know, thinking about the Black Sea terminal maybe being a little bit more risky and maybe not as much oil going out of there, you can probably get in the range of 2 or 3 million barrels a day of potential lost supply. I don't know if it's likely, but, you know, I don't see much more than that being possible because of the fact they're on Tidewater and there will be other buyers for some of that crude oil.
So those countries that are either neutral to the Russian situation or favorable even, they are able to buy Russian oil now at a discount, right?
Yes, instance, $20 cheaper than Brent, potentially, right?
Because
there's
a surplus of Russian oil as a consequence of all of this. So actually, for them, they're able to, if it's $120 Brent, they're able to get it for $100, which is still a lot for the Russians if they can assumingly monetize the dollars to rubles and all that kind of stuff through the financial systems, which they don't even probably have to go through dollars. They can go through other currencies, depending on who they're trading with, or even bartering, as sometimes happens in these sorts of situations. So, you know, it's a very fluid situation right now. There's a lot of shock and awe in the markets. There will be some rebalancing, but the region that is most vulnerable still is the European, EU region, UK region.
You know, and in terms of the what could offset it for them, you know, if we did lose in that range of, let's say, pick the middle of my range, 3 million barrels a day, well, you could see an Iran deal. I mean, it's in the news all the time. You know, sometimes says it's going to happen right away. Still a little bit uncertain, but let's say that were to happen, there's 1 million barrels a day. And then OPEC has about 2 million barrels a day of spare capacity. Now, last week they met and said they didn't plan on using that. They were just going to give their regular increase of 400,000 barrels a day each month. But I think they could be convinced with some pressure to release more of that. This is, by the way, without Russia in. That's still how much spare capacity there is. And there's also large strategic oil reserves in Europe, which we haven't talked about, for refined products and for crude oil. Now, I know there was a small release from the U.S. last week, but there is still a lot there, especially in Europe. And if you look at it, the OECD in combination, that could help Europe out.
This is sort of, it tides you over until you get some sense of rebalancing, like the demand reduction as a consequence of conservation, efficiency, economic slowdown, so on and so forth, substitution effects. You know, one of the things that I expect to see is a regression, I call it sort of a regressive transition, where when one commodity becomes far too expensive, then you switch to a lower value commodity, basically coal. So I think you're going to see a lot of countries switch from where they can, say, diesel-fired power generation, oil-fired power generation, to burning coal again. I mean, this is obviously not environmentally acceptable, but that's what happens in these sorts of energy security crises situations.
Well, and for sure that's going to happen, especially for a replacement for natural gas, right? Because natural gas, as we talked earlier, has doubled. Just for a reminder, the EU has about 30% of its gas from Russia, or about 15 BCF per day. To put that in perspective, that's about equal to all of Canadian gas production. That's how much gas Europe is taking from Russia. So it is a big problem to try to replace all that in a short amount of time. In fact, in the last week, I've seen three studies looking at how could that happen. And all of them kind of came to the same conclusion, that only about half of it could realistically be replaced, and the rest would have to come from demand destruction. Right. But that's a lot of demand destruction.
Right.
That's something like, you know, 10% of all the use of gas in Europe to balance that market. And of course, we'd need high prices.
Yeah.
So one of those things is going to be using coal to generate power and nuclear. You know, there's a discussion that some of these nuclear plants that were slated to be shut down this year are going to have their lives extended further so that there isn't so much need for natural gas.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a necessity. We will see policies that encourage alternatives, renewables in particular. The whole get off oil and gas narrative gets amplified. When that happens, you will see a structural change actually accelerated into the alternatives. But in the near term, probably meaning 2-3 years, I think you're going to see, say, regressive behavior into burning more coal until the dust settles on this thing and extending the life of nuclear.
Yeah, and even burning more wood. I was reading an article today that there's a number of power generators in Europe that rely on wood and that they're only half used today, and that there could be additional power generation from them.
Yeah, well, actually, West Coast Canadian wood pellets transit their way to Europe, if you didn't know that.
Oh, look there. There's a little factoid. Well, I guess there might be more of them trying to go that way,
probably.
If there's more wood.
I mean, I don't favor that at all. I think it's ridiculous that we burn wood to generate electricity. It's such an inefficient process, and burning forests just seems like a ludicrous proposition. But as I said, this is the kind of regressive transition that we can expect to see in the near term until such time as we see structural movement to other forms of power generation and fuel substitutions.
Well, let's talk about your article, and we'll include a link to the article in the show notes. The title was Cold War Inflation and Spiking Oil Prices, and it was a Q&A format. So I'm going to ask you some of these questions, Peter.
Sure.
Put you on the spot. This is a question that I have had quite a bit in the last week from policymakers, from the media. What can Canada do to help Europe be more energy secure? And most of the questions are like in the immediate now.
Yeah.
But maybe you could talk about now and longer term.
Well, I think it's a short conversation because there's not a lot we can do, honestly. Like, we don't have an LNG terminal built yet. We had 18 live projects only going back to about 2014. I actually looked at my old presentations, and you and I were talking about LNG projects and which ones were likely to get built. Well, only one made it. That was LNG Canada, and that's a West Coast terminal. Now, more recently, there was proposals for a couple of LNG terminals off the East Coast in Quebec, but those have been shelved as well. It doesn't matter because LNG, as you know, export terminals take years to build. So in the near term, whether it's LNG or whether it's oil, we just do not have the export port capacity to be able to do something. Now, you know, Trans Mountain, that's not coming on until late 2023 at the earliest, and that's a West Coast Pacific terminal. We really need Atlantic side export facilities to be able to help the Europeans. The only way we can really help them is if we could ramp up production, whether it's oil or gas, it would transit through the U.S. to the Gulf Coast. But if the Americans decide to cut off imports of Russian oil, our surplus capacity, if any, is going to be mopped up by the Americans before it even gets to Europe.
Yeah. Well, and the other issue is we don't have additional pipe capacity, so it would have to go by rail. Mm-hmm. And I know we do have some of those rail contracts probably still in place, but I question if there's more supply. I tell you, on the conventional side, we already talked about it. The drilling rates this winter have not been as high as we expected because it seems like there's constraints, whether it be labor or supply chain.
Huge
or
issue. Yeah.
And then on the oil sand side, maybe they could go higher, but I think with these prices, they're probably producing as much as they can. And I know there's some maintenance planned in the next months. Maybe that gets delayed, but I don't think there's really a lot of ability to add supply in the short term.
Yeah, we do produce on the oil side about 4.3, is that right now, million barrels a day of oil? Let's talk about oil.
In that range. I mean,
so to dial it up by 5 or 10% would be pretty meaningful. And you probably could do that, I suspect. But then you get into the issue of, well, how do you transport it? Certainly, there's no direct link to Europe, so it has to go to the United States and out.
But by rail.
By rail.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of rail capacity built up over the
course.
There
was. Yeah, and there were these long-term contracts that were put in place. Now, they haven't really been tested because we thought we would need them over the course of 2020. However, with what happened in 2020, we didn't need them. So in theory, there is some long-term rail contracts there that could add takeaway capacity if there's supply there.
Right, right. But I'd say like in the near term meaning the next several months, there's really nothing we could really do.
What about in the long term? Do you think that this could be a catalyst for Canada, you know, having more LNG projects? I know they take many years to build, but do you think there's appetite for thinking longer term?
I think there's going to be appetite for thinking longer term because this situation is not going to be resolved anytime soon. In other words, the propensity for Europe to want to get back on Russian gas is going to be almost nil. And they are still going to need gas for quite a while to come. So I think that there is opportunity to accelerate and reinvigorate some of these projects. But there's the companies that build these projects and finance them are going to have some assurances that the regulatory process can be fast-tracked. Otherwise, there's not much point in doing it.
Yeah, yeah, you can't take 12 plus years or something like that we have for the Trans Mountain pipeline.
No.
Or how long we've been working on LNG Canada. Like that's been a long, long time if you go back to the very beginning of the project.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think? I mean, if we fast-tracked an LNG project today, it would still be 4 or 5 years before it would get into service.
Yeah, likely. Because there is time needed for the design and all of that, right? And even if you had a short environmental process, it takes some time for these are mega projects, right?
They are.
You know, I would note the IEA released a report last week about how Europe could get off Russian gas. And one part was increasing the supply of LNG from other countries. So I know in the past, there's been this view that Europe didn't want to do that. For fact, you know, some of the reasons that Russian flows have been coming down is they wouldn't sign long-term contracts, right? So maybe there will be more opportunity for LNG projects than there would have been otherwise as a result of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the way to do it and the way that it's likely to shake out is you'll probably see more LNG export terminals being built in the Gulf Coast of the United States. You'll probably see greater export capacity for some of the other bigger LNG producers in the world, in the Middle East, and so
like
on.
Qatar. Like that.
And we could potentially see some greater flows of Canadian gas if production is raised, transiting through the U.S. all the way to the Gulf Coast and out that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely think the Americans are going to take advantage of this and have some more capacity. Let's hope Canada can too. I mean, I am hopeful, at least, you know, the project in Canada, the LNG Canada, this is just phase one. So, you know, maybe this increases the chances that the phase two of that project goes ahead.
Yeah. I mean, the only issue is that it's on the wrong coastline.
You know, I'd still say it makes a difference though, right? Like if Canadian gas can get to Asia, all things the same, that will displace, you know, some Qatari gas that can now go to Europe or something like that, right? You know, it will definitely help the tight market. All right, let's talk about the next question. Won't these high prices just accelerate the transition off oil and gas? Doesn't this sort of make the concerns around peak demand more amplified?
Near-term, no. Near-term meaning the next year or two. As I said, there's going to be regressive transition happening. However, it won't be long before we hear about policies to accelerate the transition. And this will be on top of the climate change-induced transition that we were talking about. So I give it a few months, and you're going to start to see stimulus plans and packages to accelerate infrastructure. This happened in the 1970s, where really the get-off-oil narrative accelerated. There was a lot of spending on nuclear power to push oil out of power generation. I expect, so near-term slowdown, actually. And let's not forget that there's all sorts of inflationary pressure on building new infrastructure. Every single metal and mineral is going up in cost, whether it's copper, aluminum, steel, everything. And then, of course, there's all the metals and minerals that go into batteries that's shot through the roof, too. So there's no near-term solution here. However, the long-term sort of multi-decade transition is likely to be advanced. Like the momentum for that transition could come sooner now.
Right. There might be more policy support.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, President Biden's State of the Union. I actually watched the whole thing, Peter.
Wow.
One full hour. I love that sort of thing. But it was interesting to me, in a one-hour speech, climate change was only said twice in the entire one-hour speech. And anytime they talked about clean energy, it was not because of climate change. For example, they talked about things like investment tax credits are going to lower the price of electric vehicles, saving you $80 a month, and you'll never need to pay for gasoline at the pump again.
Yeah.
You know, so saying, you know, we're going to help you get rid of being dependent on this volatile commodity. Another quote around EVs was really about it creating jobs in the Midwest, about Ford and GM making these plants and turning the Midwest from not being a rust belt anymore to being a new modern place where they're making EVs. So I thought that was interesting because I think in other years, it was all around climate change. Now, the clean energy transition has these other elements of affordability and local jobs.
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, how do people like their energy? How does society desire its energy? There's four dimensions. Energy has to be cheap, clean, safe, and secure. And the ordering of that depends upon all sorts of circumstances, including the geopolitics. Now, the last 10 years have been unusual because we've had a situation where energy was affordable, cheap, safe, and the feeling was that it was secure. There was an abundance of oil, gas.
And it's always going to be cheap. There's
solar,
always lots
rising.
Of it.
And so the whole notion of cheap, safe, and secure was that it was going to be that way forever. So we were able to concentrate on the dimension of clean, which was largely a climate change-driven discussion. But now that energy security is back in a big way and affordability or unaffordability is back in a big way, much as it was in the 1970s, you have a reshuffling of the priority deck for society. And now, as you say in Biden's speech, it's all about how can we get you your energy cheaper and how can we get your energy to you more securely? And I expect that this is going to continue for quite a while. It's not that the clean dimension is off the table, but when you have a situation where you have income inequality, extremes, inflation biting into people that don't have a lot of money and food costs are going up, and they have to commute to work somehow, the priority deck is now shuffled, and the Biden State of the Union speech reflected that.
Mm-hmm. Although, I guess the good news is that a lot of these things that are helping with affordability will also help accelerate the transition. So for those that, you know, want to solve the climate change problem, this might be helpful. It creates another motivation and maybe even a motivation to do it faster.
Yeah, I don't debate that. The only thing I would point out is that this is going to be devastating for lower income people in society. It's going to be beyond lower income. It's going to cut right into the middle class and beyond because the inflation that this generates is going to be quite acute, especially, I predict, over the course of the next year. So, yeah, it accelerates the agenda, but at pretty severe
cost.
And I think you know, if it gets too severe and we actually also run into even outright shortages, much as we did in the 70s, you could see, you know, social unrest, changes in political regimes. It's an unstable situation, which, you know, I hate to be too prophetic about it, but when we had our first podcast of the year in January, we said, you know, it's going to be a very volatile year. Well, here we are. It's more volatile than even I expected.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and high prices do ultimately solve themselves, and no matter where you go, sometimes it takes time by causing lower demand.
Yeah.
So I think when you consider the situation here with the overall economy not being all that great, you know, we still got decent economic growth, but we have this inflation. We're talking about interest rate hikes. It's a lot of things going on in the economy, and then we're throwing this on top of it as well.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and I think it's inevitable that the economy's slowing down. Everybody's talking about it. It's just that it's not going to be pleasant as it never has been in the past when we get these price spikes.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let's switch to finish off the podcast with some other news. There was a major IPCC report released last week, Climate Change 2022 Impacts Adaptation and Vulnerability. There was a lot of articles in the energy-focused publications. I would say it didn't make a lot of news in the mainstream media because there's just too much going on with Ukraine and Russia right now. But, you know, I guess, first of all, it's a 3,500-page report. It had findings, you know, that were quite alarming, like things like impacts of climate are already widespread, impacting the economy and human mortality, scenarios of what happens if the world goes beyond 1.5 that are all bad. I guess the thing I took away from it is it's really hard to read these reports and to have another alarming issue to deal with when you have another one. So to me, it just, the coverage this got, which was fairly small, considering what it maybe would have been in normal times, is symbolic of maybe people, you know, this isn't the biggest issue at this moment. And it's hard for people to deal with multiple crises.
It is. I mean, there's just a lot of doom and gloom out there. I'm wanting to sign off this podcast, frankly. you throw one more thing on top of the disturbing news out there and people just tune out. I mean, they were already, I would argue, zoned out as a consequence of five waves of the pandemic. And so I think it's going to be a while before climate change comes back to the fore, right? That energy security and affordability is going to drive the agenda, as I said. But interestingly, those issues tend to be more of a catalyst for change to get off oil, get off fossil fuels, et cetera, which we've heard that cry every time the price has spiked. And indeed, it does induce a transition. It's just that, first of all, you have to go through this difficult period of inflation and so on and so forth, economic slowdown, and a regressive transition to fuels you thought you would never use again. And then it picks up as you go forward.
Yeah, like
so that's the sequence of events that I expect. So ironically, even though the climate agenda is likely to fall back, given the immediate circumstances, the forces of change that are at play may actually accelerate the move, as we think, go to the latter half of the decade into the 2030s and the whole movement to transition our energy systems.
Okay, well, you know, to not depress you too much, I have one thing that will be happy and exciting for the last piece of news. We had lots of good feedback on our podcast with FortisBC, Tyler Brunt, about the potential for low carbon gas and an alternative to electrifying everything would be, why don't we continue to use gas, but use low carbon gas? And for those that listened very carefully, Tyler had talked about a very important supply study coming out that would show that the potential for low carbon gas in BC was much larger than anyone was sort of thinking, right? Because one of the objections is, well, there's only so much manure and sources of supply here for biogas and renewable natural gas. So the paper is out. I will put a link to it. It's 160 pages. It's an excellent resource. But the main point or the main takeaway is the amount of gas available, the supply that's potential from BC could be 2 times BC's consumption. That's both hydrogen and renewable natural gas from biofeedstocks. So the biofeedstocks by themselves could equate to BC's total consumption of gas today. Mm-hmm. So that's a major paradigm shift when it was viewed that these sources could be very small. Now, it was because the vast majority of that is coming from wood feedstocks, like mm-hmm. wood residue, wood pellets, wood that today is being used for other products, including power generation, as you just talked about, that over time we would transition that into being a feedstock for natural gas.
I think there's going to be a lot more acceptability of wanting to diversify our energy systems and even have redundancies between the different systems mm-hmm. and overlap. And so I think this is great. Yeah, it's still too expensive, but these are systems that are worth developing and putting into our energy mix so that we have redundancies to offset, you know, price spikes in one commodity versus another, or even outright shortages and so on and so forth. So I think that's going to be the theme that plays out not only here, but in Europe, is multiple alternatives and redundancy amongst the different systems.
Yeah, diversity of energy supply.
Rather than dependency on, you know, one major supplier like the Russians or one, you know, like it's just going to be, we just need redundancy.
In fact, that IEA report that came out last week with, you know, 10 steps of how to get off Russian gas, it did talk about expanding biogas, but recognized that couldn't happen in the short term. That would take longer term policy, but that was one of the one of the things that was in there. So
right. Okay.
Well, with that, we'll wrap up the podcast. Thank you for our listeners for joining. If you liked this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.